my world.
You're tuned in with the Underground Christian Network.
We want to thank you for tuning in to the Underground Christian Network. Our topic today is the Bible and your health, and uncovering some things that have been hidden from you concerning AIDS, cancer, and a series of other things. We're going to start off in Genesis chapter 1, verse 29, in our King James Version, which says, "And God says, Behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree, in the which is the fruit of the tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat." Now, I've never really heard anyone preach on this message about the Bible and health as it deals with seeds. So let's cover three things first of all. The nature of man as it's viewed in this world, the nature of sickness, and the nature of remedy. In our world today, there's two ways of viewing man. There's the creationist worldview, which says that we are special creations by Jesus Christ. Created in his image after his likeness, we are fallen creatures who have fallen from his grace through sin and only through salvation, through the grace of God, through faith in Jesus Christ, through belief in his death, burial, and resurrection, can we be saved. Then there is the worldview, the non-Christian worldview, which is evolution, which teaches that we got here through random processes over billions of years. The evolutionary viewpoint teaches that we are no more than a bunch of chemicals that got together randomly over billions of years. Therefore, if you get sick, you need to put another chemical in your body in order to balance yourself off. I'm sure some of you have heard the expression chemical imbalance. That's that evolutionary mindset coming into play. Evolution and its mindset has managed to cover science, mathematics, education, government, and even medicine. So it's about time we get the evolution out of these areas so we can have true science come forth. We know in the King James Version it contains accurate doctrine, accurate science, and accurate mathematics. It's just an accurate translation of the Word of God. So what we need to do is we need to take a look at what we're being told today about some things that are supposedly incurable. The talk here in the Bible about the seeds is very important because we learn that contained within various different seeds, mainly in the apricot seed, is a vitamin complex that is so complicated you can't even buy it in the stores. It's called vitamin B17. It's been known for more than 100 years that vitamin B17 has been very effective in curing cancer. The public hasn't been told about it, though, because the medical field is under the evolutionary mindset that teaches that if a person gets sick, you need to use a chemical to remedy them, not a seed. So while they're trying to find a chemical remedy for diseases like cancer and AIDS and so forth, they ignore biblical remedies, which can easily rid us of these things if we simply abided by them. Now, I'm going to put a disclaimer here. I'm not a doctor. I'm a researcher, and in doing this research, this is the conclusions we've come to, and we're handing you the ball, and we're saying you do some research into this too, and find out whether or not we be accurate in these things. Look into vitamin B17. This not might only change your life, but could save your life if you would put it into practice after doing your research. The nature of sickness. You did not get sick because your body desperately needed an aspirin. You did not get sick because your body desperately needed a cough medicine or a flu medicine. You usually would get sick because your body got invaded by a microscopic life form known as a virus, a germ, a bacteria, fungus, parasite, or mold, something of that caliber. It is a microscopic life form. Once it gets into your system, your immune system immediately comes into play to try to get rid of it. But your immune system has limitations. It needs some things to help it out. It was learned in the late 1800s that low-level electrical current applied to the blood helps your immune system get rid of viruses, germs, bacteria, fungus, mold, parasites, and other things that are in your blood that don't belong there. This process was so successful, in fact, that they patented it. Here's the patent number. You can go online to the United States Patent Office website and look this number up, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. The patent number is 5188738. 5188738. When you look on the description where it says description and background problem, it talks about the fact that one person donating bad blood can contaminate the whole lot of blood. It says, for this reason, this device was invented. If this device can rid your body of the AIDS virus, why hasn't the public been told about it? The United States Patent Office only patents things that work. If this device didn't work, they would not have patented it. They had to prove that this device actually works. And Dr. Kelly from the Albert Einstein School of Medicine repatented this device February 23rd, 1993. How many people have died of AIDS since February 23rd, 1993, while this device had been withheld from the public? Why was it withheld from the public? Well, looking at the schematics for this device, you can go to an electronics store and build one of these devices yourself for under $200. Doctors wouldn't make any money off of this. They're still looking for a chemical remedy. They have the charities out there collecting your money, saying they're still trying to find a cure for these things, when the remedy is sitting right there. But because it's not an evolutionary chemical remedy and doesn't end up costing you a lot of money, they just don't tell the public about it. Well, folks, that's why the Underground Christian Network is here. We're going to present to you two audios that will give you more information about this than you've probably ever learned. And we're handing you the ball so that you will run with it. If you have AIDS, if you have cancer, hepatitis, syphilis, gonorrhea, blood disease, listen to these audios. Record them to your hard drive. In time, I hope to put both of these audios in separate audios so that you can download it and burn it to a CD and give it to the people who needs it. This is research work that I'm handing to you. I give you the ball. Run with it. I hand you off first to Dr. Robert C. Beck, the man who blew the whistle on this whole thing way back in the 1990s. He held free seminars explaining about these machines. He demonstrates the machines. There is a video available about these devices. So, without any further ado, let's get down to it. My research work presented to you here today from the Underground Christian Network. We might be able to blow the lid off this thing and not only change some people's lives, but save some people's lives. As we look first of all at Dr. Robert C. Beck and these electronic devices which are used to help remedy yourselves of things like AIDS and other blood diseases. And then after that is going to be an audio from a video called World Without Cancer, which covers vitamin B17, the history of vitamin B17, the effectiveness of vitamin B17, and how important that it is. So get this information, save it to your hard drive, study it, learn it, share it, and I hope a lot of people's lives will be saved from this. This is the Underground Christian Network.
Okay. It's about 3:04 p.m. on the 16th. We're at the Pasadena Civic, for anyone who listens to the tape. You'll have to pardon the miserable shape I'm in. I had a fall a couple of months ago, and instead of bones now, I've got some titanium plates, and they haven't quite healed up, and I've got to go back and see if the doctor left some pliers or something in there. But how many of you have not heard me before today? Oh, wonderful. I think I'll take this story from the top. An absolutely incredible thing has happened in medical paradigms. And I first heard about this discovery in 1991. There was a small article in Science Digest, March 1991, telling the two doctors at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City, Dr. Stephen Kaly, K-A-A-L-I, and Dr. Wyman, had accidentally put a couple of electrode wires into a Petri dish that contained a lot of infected human blood, infected with HIV, and after passing 50 to 100 micromillionths of an ampere through the Petri dish, the virus could no longer attach to the cells. and they suggested that this would be a wonderful way to clean up the blood supplies, which were still infecting. Oh, I got some here. Thanks, Mark. Still infecting people in France and foreign countries, particularly Romania, where a lot of soldiers who had AIDS would stop over for the weekend and infect hundreds of people, run out of money, sell a pint of their blood, and the blood was contaminated, and nobody knew very much about AIDS back in the 1980s, and hundreds of babies given transfusions were dying. Well, I was immediately fascinated by this apparent accidental discovery, so I did everything I could to find a copy of the original paper. It does exist, but somebody had gone around with razor blades and cut that paper out of the proceedings, publications, and the journals. And it really looked like suppression. And shortly after this, medical doctor friends of mine... Hi, Jane.
You could tell them that I'm the person with the papers.
Okay, this is the lady with the papers, if you should choose to take any home with you. We have all of this written up in a 28-page document, so you don't need to make notes. All the patent numbers are given, all the schematic diagrams, so you can do this yourself. Any child can build this apparatus. I'm not selling anything. I do not get a penny royalty on the dozens of people now in the United States who are building these boxes. We're trying to give people back to themselves. The result is we have hundreds of previously terminal, dying, full-blown AIDS patients who are now well, symptom-free, back at work, many of whom have negative PCR, polymerase chain reaction tests. And I brought a stack of these here today. Do we have any medical professionals in the audience, MDs, chiropractors, naturopaths? I'd like for you to help me in a couple of minutes and look at these. I had to sign 5 pages of legal documents that I could not reveal this information to anyone who is not a medical professional, because of patient confidentiality and a few other problems. The first tests that we ran at a clinic in Huntington Beach, California, were so startling that the laboratory running our PCR tests, immunodiagnostic laboratory in San Leandro, one of the biggest in California, would not return the results to the medical doctors who we were using on the study. They called down there, originally accused us of substituting blood from healthy people for the ones who had had AIDS and HIV. Whether there's any connection or not, we don't know. And then the secretaries began calling our clinic and our secretaries and asking, what are you doing down there? There's no such thing as a cure for AIDS, and here these are showing up cured, which we'll show you and we'll let you observe. And if you're not a medical profession, unfortunately, I'm stuck on their confidentiality rules. Since that time, another amazing thing has happened. We began getting unsolicited reports from oncologists, cancer doctors in New Jersey that said while their patients had come in for different problems, mostly HIV, this is before we started using this for hepatitis, Epstein-Barr, herpes, many, many other diseases, that a lot of these terminal cancer patients whose disease had metastasized to the point where it was all through their bodies, and it was inoperable, had begun reporting spontaneous remissions. And I thought, this is fantasy. I don't believe it. And then they showed me some medical proof. And we had a 4-way telephone conversation between California, where I live, and New Jersey, why in the world were these people showing up negative? It's very simple. We have a couple of people here who are guests of Mike that will tell you why. They have clean blood. We have totally eliminated all of the parasites, viruses, pathogens, germs, things that were in their blood, which had been loading their immune system for many years. And when these vanished, the immune system was shown to begin producing certain neuropeptides again, for example, interleukin, interferon, and these were handling the cancer. And if you're a doctor, you realize that cancer is not necessarily a separate disease, although it is being treated like a disease by practically every oncologist in the country. Cancer is simply what happens when some of these cells turn anaerobic, get on a fermentation cycle instead of an oxygen cycle. The people's immune systems are so bad that they can't do anything about it. They're given a lot of drugs, they're given surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and they normally are charged, this is the average, your doctor will tell you, $375,000 for conventional treatments. And if they had done this, it would have cost $1.32 per cure. That's all it is for replacement batteries. Once you have an outfit which puts, three or four. Do we have any physicists or engineers or electricians in the audience? Well, the mechanism is fully described in a paper which came off the printer, this particular version, at about 8:30 last night that I've worked on the computer to update the ones you may have had from last year. But we began finding that a lot of things that were being treated as separate diseases were easily handled by the immune system once the immune system was unloaded. And we have proof of this. And I wouldn't believe anyone who told me these things unless I had looked into it personally. So, in the reference of not charging, we put this in public domain. We found that in 1993, Drs. Colley, M.D., from Einstein College of Medicine, etc., and his colleagues were given U.S. patents, number 5188573, on this process. But they were going to cure people by opening up their arms surgically, planting a little chamber consisting of a miniature battery like drives your wristwatch into the artery, the ulnar artery, leaving it until the battery had run down, opening up the arm surgically, removing the device, changing the battery, and putting it in another spot where blood was flowing past it. That's going to cost you about $20,000 to $30,000. Their other system, shown, drawn, illustrated in their patent, U.S. patent, was to take the blood out of one arm, run it through about a 14-inch plastic tube, which contained a couple of little electrodes about 1 inch apart. How many of you people have seen this patent, by the way? Oh, good. And then putting it into a bottle or into the opposite arm like dialysis. And this would take a long time until that 1 inch length of circulating blood finally got all of the volume of blood in your body past those electrodes and neutralized whatever virus, fungus, parasite, pathogens, germs were inside. Now, I have personally funded a number of studies in investigating this. And the surprise to me was that this had been invented first and patented in 1882. Again, in 1890, these patents are listed in the paper, many of them. We keep finding new ones. And why hasn't your doctor told you that there is a cure for so-called incurable diseases? They probably haven't told you because there's a tremendous difference between $375,000 to treat with allopathic remedies a person's cancer and $1.32 for healing that person who will continue to live long beyond the 5-year limit that is the average expiration date of a cancer patient, as you know, if you're in the health business. Now, that's what I'm here to talk about today. We'll go into much greater detail if you want to come to the workshop. If you have the paper, it isn't necessary for you to come to the workshop because we put everything we know about this into these 28 pages, what you do, how you do it, and the process, which is beginning to revolutionize holistic health, consists of the following. You put a little device. Do you have one there, Mike? Oh, yeah. You put a little device on your ulnar and radial arteries, which you locate by feeling your pulse. And do you have one of yours there, Russ? Oh, we'll show you a lot of stuff a little bit later. You run about 3 to 5 milliamperes through the skin, which results in 50 to 100 microamperes flowing through the circulating blood. We do this for 1 or 2 hours a day until almost every drop of the blood in your body flows normally through the radial and ulnar branches of the arteries up to a joint in your elbow where you're given your shots and back down again. When that blood passes the electrodes and this very small current enters it, and there are many, many U.S. patents where this process has been rediscovered for over 112 years. Cures, pardon me, I'm not supposed to use that word, causes spontaneous remissions of practically any known disease. And all of these are described, and you can build them. There are circuit diagrams in here and parts lists, but a lot of people have bought the parts and the kits, and they become frustrated. They don't know which end of the soldering iron to bind, so we really recommend that you buy a finished, tested, proven unit from one of these two vendors. And what's your booth, Mike?
111.
And what's your booth, Russ?
65.
Look at these. Forgive me, Mike, but I kind of prefer Russ's magnetic pulse generator to yours, but I think you've got a beautiful blood cleaner. The second thing you do after you've run the small current through your blood daily for about 21 days, that's all it takes normally, is we scavenge the residual disease cells which might be germinating or, well, let's say they're incubating in your lymph tissue. That's what your lymph is for. We have about 5 times by volume as much lymph fluid in our healthy bodies as we have blood. To get rid of that, to make sure that the sick person does not reinfect himself in a few months to a few years, we drive this magnetic pulse, which Mike will demonstrate about now, of about 20,000 gauss through a coil which he's holding up.
Can you hear me up there?
You want to tell us about that, Mike? I'm sorry, I mean Russ. Use the mic here. Well, let him demonstrate it, because this puts out an occult force by the preferred dictionary definition, a hidden force. And, go ahead.
Okay, basically, what we're going to be doing here is demonstrating a magnetic field, very intense magnetic field. As Bob mentioned, it's an occult force, meaning that we can't see it, touch it, feel it, hear it, nothing. And the way to demonstrate it, I'm going to energize this coil with our unit, the magnetic pulse unit, and I've got a standard 3/8-inch truck washer here, which I'm going to place inside the coil and pulse the unit. And if this thing works, we should see a movement from the washer. So let's give it a try. So the unit is fully charged up. And there it is. Should I charge up again? Made it to the top that time. So as you can see here, that we're getting a very fast moving magnetic field, and that's very, very important. It's not like a permanent magnet. And so it shot this washer up at least to that top. And then Bob will explain the importance of using a magnetic field. There we are.
Thank you, Russ. The third thing that we find fairly necessary in causing all these spontaneous remissions, and we have massive documentation on this now. No one has to take my word for it. But this is a glass of Pasadena tap water. I will make sure this laser does not hit you in your eyes. It'll go up. I want you to... I hope this laser is still working.
Right back here on the screen.
Let's shine this beam through this glass of water. And you can see a little bit of crud floating around in the water. But I'm going to do something magical to this water. We're going to make what is probably the best colloid that money can buy. And both Mike and Russ make excellent colloid generators. And they are built in to the little devices. And we're going to leave this, we're putting 27 volts through this anode and cathode, which is a 99.9% pure silver, putting it through the water, and by electrolysis, we're making ionic silver colloid, which is far better than you can normally buy, and the colloid will cost you 0.1 cents per gallon. The water costs 800 times more than the colloid. When you buy a gallon of distilled water, Arrowhead or Sparklets at the supermarket, that gallon of water will cost you about 80 cents. When you figure how much silver have we used and how much current, you're adding a tenth of a cent and you're making a colloid, which if you bought it on the floor down here, would cost you $50 to $90, not a tenth of a penny. Now, you remember what this water looked like a couple of minutes ago. Now, when I put the laser beam through the identical glass of tap water, and this battery is just about to give up the goat. You got a laser there?
Yes. There
you go. Oh, great. Remind me to change batteries.
Just
thank you, man.
Button,
The reason the laser beam looks solid is the Rayleigh-Raleigh effect, R-A-L-E-I-G-H, or the Tyndall, T-Y-N-D-A-L-L effect, like phase contrast or dark field microscopy. You can see the light hitting these 001 micron, 10 billionths of an inch, sized particles in this glass and backscattering to your health. You can drink as much of this as you want. You will not get a gloria unless you drink silver nitrate, silver proteins. If you stick to the ionic, metallic, genuine silver colloid, you can do miracles, because the colloid gives you a second immune system which will handle the opportunistic infections in case you're dealing with someone with a damaged immune system. People have made the mistake of giving this to their cats. The cats are acting like kittens again and jumping all over the furniture. The cats aren't going to the veterinarian every month with runny eyes, running ears, and running noses. And some of the cats won't drink water anymore unless the owner puts a teaspoon or two of colloid in it. So I think the cats know something, maybe that we don't. But the full process is described in your paper in about 8 or 9 articles, lists of the 650 different diseases that the colloid handles and how to make your own and what to do with it. Was there a question back here?
I just
wanted to say, what's the dog too? Oh, yes. They're using it for horses. They're using it for dairy cows in Northern California. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. I've heard varying opinions on whether the colloidal silver will kill off the beneficial bacteria in the intestine.
A long time ago, like 3 years, we used to take acidophilus, etc. We don't find it's necessary. They don't get that far down into the intestines. They get into the blood. Yes?
Water source had nitrates or other products in it. Could you form?
Well, there's something to do about that. You ozonate the water. This is the fourth and last leg on this stool that we found causes spontaneous remissions of about everything, and it's fully described in your paper.
Can you ozonate with hydrogen peroxide?
Can you what?
Can you ozonate with hydrogen peroxide?
No, that won't ozonate. H2O2 is just oxygen. Peroxide is used in Europe to purify water instead of chlorine, fluorine, etc. On the back page of your paper, and they're available from Jane. Jane, where are you sitting? Oh, hello there. These papers have got about 500 hours of my own research. They cost me a couple of bucks to Xerox, or they did last night because we had to go to a 5 cent a page place. But all of these processes that I'm talking about are being fully described, and I can guarantee if you don't like this paper, I'll personally give you your money back. I think I've done a beautiful job, and if you look on the date, it says January the 15th, 1998. And all of the locations for placing the electrodes are stolen out of Gray's Anatomy, with which very few people argue. All of the lymph sites are stolen out of about 3 medical textbooks, including Gray's Anatomy. In other words, we made this idiot-proof. We had a lady walk up today and say she didn't understand it. She'd gotten a machine, and I thought, oh, my God, we have 10-year-old kids. Well, never mind. But it is one of the simplest things you can do, far simpler than getting shots or surgery or all of the things that people are doing. Now, I can't tell you how much effort has gone into suppressing these data. It would be unethical for me to tell you what we found out about the original discoverers. I suspect I know who's paying them off to keep this information from you, but every single bit of this information is available in a 28-page paper. There's no sense in anyone suffering. Yes?
They use a creatinine blood test to determine the your functioning of your kidney, and they also test for...
I'm really embarrassed that I cannot answer any medical questions directly because it is a felony. They can put me in jail in California if I answer
them. Let me rephrase the question. Will this purify toxicity from the blood?
The ozone will definitely do that. Now, Mike had a couple of guests. Are they...
Rick?
We'll tell you about the amazing story of immortal blood. Mike was the first person on whom this was observed. After he had done the blood cleaning, he went to Michael Coyle, who was in Boulder at the time. They looked at his blood, and Mike threw the slide with the cover slip in a box of toxic wastes that's normally picked up every month and disposed of by most states' laws. Coyle looked into the box, and there were a couple of slides that had not changed color. You know what blood looks like after it's been drawn for a while, dark, dirty brown. This blood was sparkling, yellow, orange. He took it after 28 days, looked at it under his microscope, and the blood was still alive. Now, drawn blood lasts about 4 days, and it's dead. And why was this blood still alive, which they dubbed immortal blood? Because there were no background parasites. You can see your blood just teeming with these things if you go in for a dark field or phase contrast test. That blood was practically immortal. Now, what's it going to do to some of us older people like myself? I'll be 73 this month. That whose blood no longer has things which are loading the immune system. We don't even know. But we have dozens of papers from doctors and patients who have absolutely experienced complete recoveries by doing this themselves. I hate to tell you this, but you do not need a doctor. You do not need herbs, pharmaceuticals, medicines, homeopathic remedies, no sods. This does almost everything you need. There are two side effects. One is called electroporation. With some people, no matter what you have ingested or eaten or taken in the way of medicine, will have an effect that is amplified 20 to 30 times normal when you start the blood electrification or the magnetic pulsing on your body. It could be toxic. Garlic is considered good for you by most people. The sulfone hydroxyl has nearly killed a few people who have eaten a little salad dressing and then wired up the blood electrifier or used the magnetic pulser. A friend of mine, Charlie, had stopped by the Formosa Bar and Grill on Santa Monica one day, and he normally had a pitcher of beer. This day, he took only one glass, decided to wire up before he got home, got out to his car, put the wrist electrodes on, managed to drive his car for about two blocks before he was so drunk he could no longer steer, and he pulled into the Ralph's supermarket and slept for 2 hours before he could get home. And this is what it had done by amplifying the alcohol in the blood. If I take two aspirin, I'm okay. If I take 60 aspirin at the same time, I'm in trouble. And this is what the electroporation can do. So if you absolutely must take prescription remedies, do it immediately after you have turned off the electrifier, then wait 24 hours for that to decay in your plasma, and do it again. Now, some people are not affected by the electroporation. Many are. One lady had her cup of coffee after wiring up, did not sleep for 2 days and 3 nights. In other words, this can, not always, we would say does, but it can. And you can read about this in a paper which is mentioned in here that was turned out in 1993 by Harvard Medical Group in the chemistry of cellular medicine. We've given you all the references where you can do this safely, but you must follow the instructions. Finally, we've put together the other side effect that we did not like was detoxification. This is called Herxheimer's syndrome. We had to slowly cure a number of the AIDS patients, some of whom were so sick that it took 2 attendants to lift them from their deathbed to the potty and lift them back and wire them up on their intravenous again. All of these people are now well, healthy, and back at work and symptom-free. And most have clean PCR tests, which makes me wonder whether Peter Duisberg's theory that HIV has nothing to do with AIDS, but it is a combination of other factors. Now, this little device has a pump. A lead acid gel cell, 12 volts, that drives an ionizer that Russ is buying probably offshore. And you bubble this ozone, which is taken out of the atmosphere. You do not need bottles of medical oxygen. Your air is 19% oxygen. Oh, let's do it so you can see it. And this is the sure way that's been known for 50 years to remove all contamination from any kind of water, dirty water. It gets rid of the germs much faster than hydrogen peroxide, H2O2. And these little bubbles of about 100 milligram or milliliter per hour.
Per hour is that unit, yes.
Bubbling through the water, oxidize any impurities, and when you drink this water, your body just can't get enough. We test people by using a NELCOR, N-E-L-L-C-O-R, blood oxygen meter, which attaches to the fingertips and tells you the exact percent of saturated oxygen that your hemoglobin is carrying through the body. Most people run 93 to 95, maybe a trained athlete will have 96% oxygen in his blood. Within 2.5 to 3 minutes after you drink ozonized water, which has a half-life of only about 20 minutes, which is why you have to make it ingested immediately, within 2.5 or 3 minutes, their percentage of blood oxygen saturation normally goes to 100%. And you will be amazed at how you will feel when oxygen gets to your brain cells. You'll begin remembering telephone numbers you haven't thought of since high school. We're kind of running out of time, but make it quick. Tap water. You can do it in distilled water, but I don't like to pay 80 cents a gallon. This makes tap water much purer than most distilled water because it literally oxidizes and changes to H2O plus CO2, anything by oxidation which is in that water. Yes?
Do I found it difficult, actually. It doesn't conduct as well in distilled water, I've noticed. And I don't know why exactly, because I do drink purified water. And it doesn't conduct the silver color.
Well, I'd like to take time to answer that, but the answer is in the paper. And if you don't want to buy one, I'll give you one right now. Here. Oh, okay. Yes, ma'am.
Would we need both that oxygenated water and the silver colloidal water? Do you need both?
I make the oxygenated water at the same time I make the colloid. And I drink it at the same time. You need four things: a blood cleaner, the magnetic pulser, a colloid maker, and an oxygen machine. And then you just need to go into somebody on his deathbed and turn him around and make him immortal. Hooray. And we've done it over and over until I'm no longer surprised. We've done 21-month-old babies who had AIDS, who don't anymore. We've done, just so many people, hundreds. Now, would you help me a second? We're running out of time, but come to the workshop if you want to know any. Come on up here a second. These are polymerase chain reaction tests. Let's get one here that's a little more dramatic. If you'll look at the dates, less than 100 copies is zero with IDL labs because that's the lowest they can read on their microscopes. On 9/20/96, this patient was cured. But if we look here on 12/95, this patient had 165,165 HIV particles per milliliter per cubic centimeter of his blood. Now, when these reports started coming back to us in Huntington Beach, that was an interim study. These are complete blood tests. Let's just flip through these fast, because once you have seen these with your own eyes, it gives you an entirely different feel over these people who are selling you ideas that are mostly baseless, if you'll pardon the French. This person on 4/5/96 had 63,888 PCR. Now, this person has less than 100 copies, and this was 2 months later. We have stacks of these reports, clinical reports. This one had 412,000 and 1,600 on 9/6/95. And now he's totally reversed with less than 100 copies per milliliter. And this really shook up some laboratory people who said, haven't you read the paper? There is no cure for AIDS. And I said, there has been a perfectly valid, workable cure for AIDS since 1990. And I can prove it to you by showing you the laboratory reports and the places where this paper has been republished. For example, biomedicine section, March 30th, 1991, page 207. And this is reprinted in your paper so you can show people who might not believe that this has been around and your doctors haven't told you about it because there's no money in it. And you don't need a doctor to cure any of these things, AIDS or cancer. And shocking treatment proposed for AIDS, etc. And we can go on down this stack of PCRs, but are you... I have to tell you, I haven't altered these at all. That one was RNA, but I rewrote this because they had used a colored pencil to mark them out. 12,764. Now, less than 100 copies. Another cure. Some of these were from a different outfit, the Jewish Hospital of Pathology Lab. The best they could do is read to less than 100 copies. In other words, these laboratory reports have come from all over the world, absolutely proving that these dying patients with full-blown AIDS are well now. Let me give you this, and thank you very much. We have stacks of cancer cures proven. Last week, a friend of ours, Jack Wilson, who had a tumor on his neck the size of an orange and had been sent home to die by the Veterans Administration Hospital. He was a captain. They said, "You have no time. You have 4 weeks to live." When he came to Carol's restaurant last week, he was all smiles. He had a stack of medical reports proving that he did have carcinoma. Absolutely clean, not one cancer cell in his body. He was one of our happiest people, and I had kind of an emotional investment in Jack. He was a personal friend. So he was one of a number of people that I have personally followed through this, and they're still paying $375,000 average per cure that might keep them alive for 5 years. And all of this is fully explained in your paper. And Jane, are you still there? Okay, we really recommend that you pick up this paper because it's going to tell you some things with documentation. There she is. She's the blonde lady with... Get your papers. You'll love them. We spent a lot of time. I'm not making a nickel on this. Thank God I'm more or less independent, so I can afford to do it. Pardon me. What? Yeah, go ahead.
It said, safe for any person, since there's always the presence of pathogenics in the blood. It said, safe for any person to do this, the microsurgery.
Is it safe for any person to do this?
And expect any presence or any pathology to go away, regardless of the magnitude of the pathology?
We have not had any problems yet, except for one guy, Paul Gallagher, who ate some garlic and got very sick. So we specifically warned him against the sulfone hydroxyl atoms in the garlic. Don't take any garlic when you start this. Remember that gangsters used to rub the tips of their bullets in garlic. Then they could just wing somebody and they would surely die. Organic gardeners use garlic to kill any insects because they can't get the original pesticides, which were outlawed 36 years ago. Yes, ma'am. My paper was updated on January the 15th, yesterday. I spent two whole days and nights in it. And it is now 28 pages, and it's full of additional feedback. And did you want to say anything there, Russ? Or?
Hey, do you want me to mention the small child, or it's up to you how the time is going?
Yeah, come up here and take a couple of minutes. We've got to really crowd things because of the time limitation here. If she's on medication, don't do blood electrification. We want her to live. Medications all have side effects. Their effect is amplified in the blood, as I've said. It's all explained in your paper, given the Harvard medical references of why. Go ahead.
We had an interesting story of a lady who had a three-month-old baby. And it was a baby that she was a foster parent. The baby came into her possession. It was born with HIV. And the doctors put the baby on an AZT cocktail. And for the next number of months, not too sure the period of time was, the baby did not respond very well. These drugs are very hard on the baby. She heard about the colloidal silver at a friend of hers from church and started giving the baby colloidal silver. At the same time, she took the baby off the AZT, and immediately the baby started to respond positively. She got a PCR test, and the count actually went up. As soon as she came off the AZT, the count went up to 410,000 from 120. She kept it on colloidal silver for approximately 3 months, at which time there was very little change in the PCR test, but the baby responded very favorably. And she thought, well, okay, it seems to be working, but it wasn't all. Then she heard that there was another sign to all this, the blood electrification, which she was not even aware of. So she called us up, and we sent her down a unit, and she put the baby on the blood electrification unit, as Bob has mentioned, the small unit here. And within, I believe it was 6 weeks, she went ahead another PCR test. And up in Alaska, where she lives, the machine that they use to do the PCR test is a very sensitive unit. The count went from 410,000 down to 265.
Wow.
And she said, that's basically below detectable levels with all other machines. It just the one in Anchorage was extremely sensitive. So for all intents and purposes, she said that baby now is HIV-free. Now, what was the most amazing thing, this is a baby. It didn't know what was going on, and if that can be turned around, that's what, again, gave us another level of confidence in this particular therapy. You can't fool the kids.
Thank you. We've had absolutely incredible results with this. We don't expect anyone to believe it until he or she sees the PCR and cancer tests. There is a revolution in medicine today. It is fully explained in your paper. I highly recommend you get one. You do not need any additional information. And any idiot, any child who's 10 years old, can speak English and has an IQ of about 60, can do this without surgery, drugs, pharmaceuticals, herbs, medicines, doctors, nurses, homeopaths, magicians, shamans. Get off that crap and get well. And take back your power. Yeah. It's practically free. You're getting this for practically the cost that we paid at Kinko's for Xeroxing at midnight because I wanted them ready for today. And how's our time running? Okay, I should cut it off now. Apparently we're out of time. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, there's one free lecture, absolutely free lecture, on Saturday, tomorrow, at about 2 o'clock. Another one on Sunday in this same room at, I think it's 11 o'clock. Come back. And if you really want to see the details and where you put the electrodes and get the ins and outs, come to the workshop, which will be tonight in this room at 5 o'clock, or the one next door. So that's it. Thank you very much for listening to me, and come on up. And if I've taken any of your time, I'm very...
That covers the first part, dealing with blood purifiers and the cure for AIDS. If you want more information on this, you can search on the Internet under the topic of blood purifiers or blood electrification. You can also look under Dr. Robert C. Beck. These devices that he spoke of are available online if anybody wants to get a hold of them. All four of these items, the colloidal silver, the water ozonators, the blood electrifiers, they are available online. Some of them are one machine that does multiple things, you know, several things on one machine, and they're very affordable. So I hand my research work over to you, and now we hand the ball over to the cure for cancer.
For over two decades, there has been a steadily growing group of people who have accepted the vitamin theory of cancer and who have altered their diets accordingly. They represent all walks of life, all ages, both sexes, and reside in almost every advanced nation in the world. It's estimated that there are many thousands in the United States alone. Now, it's true that there's no way to determine their exact number or to conduct clinical examinations on each of them. But they do constitute a rather well-defined group that is both vocal and conspicuous. It's significant, therefore, that after starting and maintaining a diet rich in vitamin B17, none of these people has ever been known to contract cancer. Now let's repeat that statement. While their fellow citizens are suffering from cancer at the rate of 1 out of every 4, not one of these thousands has ever been known to contract this dread disease. Welcome to the Reality Zone. I'm Ed Griffin. The program we are about to hear is taken from the soundtrack of a documentary film originally produced in 1974. It's based upon my book, World Without Cancer, The Story of Vitamin B17. Even without the visuals, the audio portion of this film is easy to follow, and you'll find it more than sufficient to carry the message. Thousands of video copies of this film are in circulation now throughout the United States. Over 1 million people have heard its message, and many of those now claim that their lives have been saved because they followed its advice. Well, much has happened since then. The book has been reprinted many times and eventually revised into a second edition to keep abreast of new developments. But the basic story has not changed. It's a story about fraud in America's cancer industry, about billions of dollars squandered in dead-end research, about treatments that kill more patients than they cure, about cancer charities that prey upon a gullible public, about drug cartels and their hidden impact on the medical profession. But most important of all, it's about how you can become protected from cancer. We believe that the information contained is vital to the health and well-being of you and your family, and it's for that reason that we now present World Without Cancer. This year, 350,000 Americans will die from cancer. 1 out of 4 of us will develop cancer in our lifetime. That's over 50 million people in the United States alone. The purpose of this presentation is to show that this great human tragedy can be stopped now entirely on the basis of existing scientific knowledge. We'll explore the theory that cancer, like scurvy or pellagra, is a deficiency disease, aggravated by the lack of an essential food compound in modern man's diet, and that its ultimate control is to be found simply in restoring this substance to our daily intake. We are not in the business of promoting vitamins, food supplements, or products of any kind. We are not prescribing any course of treatment. We endorse nothing except freedom of choice. We have nothing to sell but facts. What you are about to hear does not carry the approval of organized medicine. The Food and Drug Administration, the American Cancer Society, and the American Medical Association have labeled it fraud and quackery. The average physician, however, is less dogmatic. He's more apt to say, let's give it a try and then pass judgment. Consequently, an increasing number of doctors all over the world now are testing and proving in their own clinics that the vitamin concept of cancer is true. With billions of dollars spent each year on research, with other billions taken in from the cancer-related sale of drugs, and with vote-hungry politicians promising ever-increasing government programs, we find that today there are more people making a living from cancer than are dying from it. If the riddle were to be solved by a simple vitamin, this gigantic commercial and political industry could be wiped out overnight. The result is that the science of cancer therapy isn't nearly as complicated as the politics of cancer therapy. In the past, the FDA and other agencies of government have used every means at their disposal to prevent this story from being told. They've arrested citizens for holding public meetings to tell others of their convictions on this subject. They've confiscated films and books. They even now are prosecuting doctors who apply these theories in an effort to save the lives of their own patients. With this background in mind, it may appear to be the height of folly to proceed with this presentation. But ladies and gentlemen, if the story that follows is true, as we firmly are convinced it is, then in the name of humanity, someone simply has to stand up against the bureaucracy. And we are determined to do it. The history of science is the history of struggle against entrenched error. Many of the world's greatest discoveries initially were rejected by the scientific community, and those who pioneered those discoveries often were ridiculed and condemned as quacks and charlatans. Columbus was bitterly attacked for believing the earth was round. Bruno was burned at the stake for claiming the earth was not the center of the universe. Galileo was imprisoned for teaching that the earth moved around the sun. Even the Wright brothers were ridiculed and condemned for claiming that a machine could fly above the earth. In the field of medicine, Andreas Vesalius was denounced as an impostor and heretic because of his discoveries in the field of human anatomy. William Harvey was disgraced as a physician for believing that blood was pumped by the heart and actually moved around the body through arteries. And Ignaz Semmelweis was fired from his hospital post for requiring his maternity staff to wash their hands. Centuries ago, it wasn't unusual for entire naval expeditions to be wiped out by scurvy. Between 1600 and 1800, the casualty list of the British Navy alone was over 1 million sailors. Medical experts of the time were baffled as they searched in vain for some kind of a strange bacterium, virus, or toxin that supposedly lurked in the dark holds of ships. And yet, for hundreds of years, the cure was already known and written in the record. In the winter of 1535, when the French explorer Jacques Cartier found his ships frozen in the ice off the St. Lawrence River, scurvy began to take its deadly toll. Out of a crew of 110, 25 already had died, and most of the others were so ill they weren't expected to recover. And then a friendly Indian showed them the simple remedy. Tree bark and needles from the white pine, both rich in ascorbic acid or vitamin C, were stirred into a drink which produced immediate improvement and swift recovery. Upon returning to Europe, Cartier reported this incident to the medical authorities, but they were amused by such witch doctor cures of ignorant savages, and they did nothing to follow it up. Yes, the cure for scurvy was known, but because of scientific arrogance, it took over 200 years and cost hundreds of thousands of lives before the medical experts began to accept and apply this knowledge. Finally, in 1747, John Lind, a young surgeon's mate in the British Navy, discovered that oranges and lemons produced relief from scurvy, and recommended that the Royal Navy include citrus fruits in the stores of all its ships. And yet, it still took 48 more years before his recommendation was put into effect. The 20th century has proven to be no exception to this pattern. Only a generation ago, large portions of the American Southeast were decimated by the dread disease of pellagra, which was thought to be contagious and probably caused by an as-yet undiscovered virus. As far back as 1914, Dr. Joseph Goldberger had proven that this condition was related to diet and later showed that it could be prevented simply by eating liver or yeast. But it wasn't until the 1940s, almost 30 years later, that the medical world fully accepted pellagra as a vitamin B deficiency. By 1952, Dr. Ernst T. Krebs, Jr., a biochemist in San Francisco, had advanced the theory that cancer, like scurvy or pellagra, is not caused by some kind of mysterious bacterium, virus, or toxin, but is merely a deficiency disease aggravated by the lack of an essential food compound in modern man's diet. He identified this compound as part of the nitrilicide family, which occurs abundantly in nature in over 1,200 edible plants and found virtually in every part of the world. It's particularly prevalent in the seeds of fruits, but also is contained in grasses, maize, sorghum, millet, cassava, linseed, bitter almonds, and many other foods that generally have been deleted from the menus of modern civilization. A chronic disease is one which usually doesn't pass away of its own accord. A metabolic disease is one which arises within the body and isn't transmittable to another person. Cancer, therefore, is defined as a chronic metabolic disease. Dr. Krebs has pointed out that in the entire history of medical science, there hasn't been one chronic metabolic disease that was ever cured and prevented by drugs or mechanical manipulation of the body. In every case, the ultimate solution was found only in factors relating to adequate nutrition. And he thinks that this is an important clue as to where to concentrate our scientific curiosity in the search for a better understanding of cancer. But there are other clues as well. Before looking at the more technical aspects of Dr. Krebs' theory, it's well that we examine some of them. For example, Domesticated pets often seek out certain grasses to eat, even though they're adequately filled by other foods. This is particularly likely to happen if the animals are not well. It's interesting to note that the grasses selected by instinct are Johnson grass, Tunis grass, Sudan grass, and others that are especially rich in nitrilicides, or vitamin B17. Monkeys and other primates at the zoo, when given a fresh peach or apricot, will carefully pull away the sweet fleshy part, crack open the hard pit, and devour the small seed that remains. Instinct compels them to do this, even though they've never seen that kind of fruit before. These seeds are one of the most concentrated sources of nitrilicides to be found anywhere in nature. Wild bears are great consumers of nitrilicides in their natural diet. Not only do they seek out berries that are rich in this substance, but when they kill small grazing animals for their own food, instinctively they pass over the muscle portions and consume first the viscera and rumen, which are filled with nitrilicide grasses. In captivity, animals seldom are allowed to eat all the foods of their instinctive choice. In the San Diego Zoo, for example, the routine diet for bears, although adequate in volume and nutritious in many other respects, is almost totally devoid of nitrilicides. In one grotto alone, over a six-year period, five bears died of cancer. It was generally speculated by the experts that a virus had been the cause. Now, it's highly significant that one never finds cancer in the carcasses of wild animals killed in the hunt. These creatures contract the disease only when they are domesticated by man and forced to eat the foods that he provides and the scraps from his table. Dr. George M. Briggs, professor of nutrition at the University of California, has said, "The typical American diet is a national disaster. If I fed it to pigs or cows without adding vitamins and other supplements, I could wipe out the livestock industry." A brief look at the American diet tells the story. Grocery shelves now are lined with high carbohydrate foods that have been processed, refined, synthesized, artificially flavored, and loaded with chemical preservatives. Some manufacturers even boast of how little real food there is in their product. Millet once was the nation's staple grain. It is high in nitrilicide content, but now it's been replaced by wheat, which has practically none at all. Sorghum cane has been replaced by sugar cane with the same result. Even our cattle are fed increasingly on quick-growing, low-nitrilicide grasses, so there's less vitamin B17 residue in the meat we eat. In some places, livestock now are being fed a diet containing 15% paper to fatten them quicker for market. And so we see that in the past 50 years, the foods that once provided the American people with ample amounts of natural vitamin B17 gradually have been pushed aside or replaced altogether by foods almost devoid of this factor. Significantly, it's during this same time span that the cancer rate has moved steadily upward to the point where today, one out of every four persons in the United States is destined to contract this disease. The ultimate scientific test of the vitamin theory of cancer would be to take a large number of people, numbering in the thousands, and over a period of many years, expose them to a consistent diet of rich nitrilicide foods, and then check the results. Fortunately, this already has been done. In the remote recesses of the Himalaya Mountains, between West Pakistan, India, and China, there is a tiny kingdom called Hunza. These people are known world over for their amazing longevity and good health. It's not uncommon for Hunzikuts to live beyond 100 years, and some even to 120 or more. Visiting medical teams from the outside world report that there never has been a case of cancer in Hunza. Although presently accepted science is unable to explain why these people should be free of cancer, it's interesting to note that the average Hunza diet contains over 200 times more nitrilicide than the average American diet. In fact, in that land where there is no such thing as money, a man's wealth is measured by the number of apricot trees he owns. And the most prized of all foods is considered to be the apricot seed. It's also interesting to learn that when the Hunzikuts leave their secluded land and adopt the menus of other countries, they soon succumb to the same diseases and infirmities, including cancer, as the rest of mankind. The Eskimos are another people that have been observed by medical teams for many decades and found to be totally free of cancer. The traditional Eskimo diet is amazingly rich in nitrilicides that come from the residue in the meat of caribou and other grazing animals, and also from the salmon berry, which grows abundantly in the Arctic areas. When the Eskimo abandons his traditional way of life and begins to rely on westernized foods, he becomes even more cancer-prone than the average American. There are many other peoples in the world that could be cited with the same characteristics. The Abkhazians near the Black Sea, the Hopi and Navajo Indians of North America, certain native populations in South America and South Africa. From all races and all regions of the world, the one thing they have in common is that the degree to which these people are free from cancer is in direct proportion to the amount of nitrilicides or vitamin B17 found in their native diet. In answer to this, the skeptic may argue that these primitive groups aren't exposed to the same cancer-producing elements that modern man is, and perhaps that's why they're immune. Let them breathe the same smog-filled air, smoke the same cigarettes, swallow the same chemicals added to their food or drinking water, use the same soaps or deodorants, and then see how they fare. This, of course, is a valid point, but fortunately, even that question now has been resolved by experience. For over two decades, there has been a steadily growing group of people who have accepted the vitamin theory of cancer and who have altered their diets accordingly. They represent all walks of life, all ages, both sexes, and reside in almost every advanced nation in the world. It's estimated that there are many thousands in the United States alone. Now, it's true that there's no way to determine their exact number or to conduct clinical examinations on each of them, but they do constitute a rather well-defined group that is both vocal and conspicuous. It's significant, therefore, that after starting and maintaining a diet rich in vitamin B17, none of these people has ever been known to contract cancer. Now, let's repeat that statement. While their fellow citizens are suffering from cancer at the rate of 1 out of every 4, not one of these thousands has ever been known to contract this dread disease. For many persons, the logic of all these facts put together is so great that it would be easy to close the case right here. But in view of the powerful opposition against this concept, let's not content ourselves only with the logic of the theory. Let's reinforce our convictions with the science of the theory also, that we may understand why it works the way our logic tells us that it must. In 1902, John Beard, a professor of embryology at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, reported that there were no discernible differences between highly malignant cancer cells and certain pre-embryonic cells that were quite normal in the early stages of pregnancy. In technical terms, these normal cells are called trophoblasts. Extensive research had led Professor Beard to the conclusion that cancer and trophoblast are, in fact, one and the same. His theory, therefore, is known as the trophoblastic thesis of cancer. The trophoblast in pregnancy indeed does exhibit all the classical characteristics of cancer. It spreads and multiplies rapidly as it eats its way into the uterus wall, preparing a place where the embryo can attach itself for maternal protection and nourishment. The trophoblast is formed as a result of a chain reaction, starting with another cell, identified as the diploid totipotent. For our purposes, let's call this simply the total life cell, because it contains within it all the separate characteristics of the complete organism and has the total capacity to evolve into any organ or tissue, or for that matter, into the complete embryo itself. About 80% of these total life cells are located in the ovaries or testes, where they serve as a genetic reservoir for future offspring. The rest of them are distributed elsewhere in the body for a purpose not yet fully understood, but which may involve the regenerative or healing process of damaged tissue. The hormone estrogen is well known for its ability to affect changes in living tissue. Although it's generally thought of as a female hormone, it's found in both sexes and performs many vital functions. Wherever the body is damaged, either by physical trauma, chemical action, or illness, estrogen always appears in great quantities, possibly serving as a stimulator or catalyst for body repair. It's now known that the total life cell is triggered into producing trophoblast when it comes into contact with estrogen. When this happens to those total life cells that have evolved from the fertilized egg, the result is a placenta and umbilical cord, a means of nourishing the embryo. But when it occurs non-sexually as part of the general healing process, the result is cancer. cancer begins to form, the body reacts by attempting to seal it off and surrounding it with cells that are similar to those in the location where it occurs. A bump or lump is the usual result. Under microscopic examination, most of these tumors are found to resemble a mixture or hybrid of both trophoblast and surrounding cells, a fact which has led many researchers to the premature conclusion that there are many different types of cancer. But the degree to which various tumors appear to be different is the same degree to which they're benign, which means that it's the degree to which there are non-cancerous cells within it. The greater the malignancy, the more these tumors begin to resemble each other, and the more clearly they begin to take on the classic characteristics of pregnancy trophoblast. And the most malignant of all cancers, the chorion epitheliomas, are almost indistinguishable from trophoblast cells. For as Dr. Beard pointed out over 70 years ago, they're one and the same. Let's turn now to the question of defense mechanisms. Before we can hope to conquer cancer, first we must understand how nature conquers cancer, how nature protects the body and controls the growth of trophoblast cells. All animals contain billions of white blood cells. One of the functions of these cells is to attack and destroy anything that is foreign and harmful to our bodies. For this reason, it would seem logical that they would attack cancer cells also. But since cancer is trophoblast, and since trophoblast is not foreign to the body, but is in fact a vital part of the life cycle, nature has provided it with a very effective means of avoiding the white cells. One of the characteristics of the trophoblast is that it's surrounded by a thin protein coating that carries a negative electrostatic charge. The white cells also have a negative charge, and since similar polarities repel each other, the trophoblast is well protected. Part of the solution to this problem is found in the pancreas, which secretes an enzyme called trypsin. When this enzyme reaches the trophoblast in sufficient quantity, it digests the protective protein coat. The cancer then is exposed to the attack of the white cells, and it dies. Applying this to the embryo, we find that the trophoblast cells there continue to grow and spread right up to the eighth week. And then suddenly, with no apparent reason, they stop growing and are destroyed. Recent research has provided the explanation. It's in the eighth week that the baby's pancreas begins to function. Now, it's significant that the upper intestines, near the point where the pancreas empties into it, is the one place in the human body where cancer is almost never found. We note also that diabetics, those who suffer from a pancreas malfunction, are three times more likely to contract cancer than non-diabetics. These facts, which have puzzled medical investigators for years, at last can be explained in light of the trophoblastic thesis of cancer. But what happens if the pancreas is weak, or if the rate of cancer growth is so high that the enzyme trypsin can't keep up with it? Then what? The answer is that nature has provided a backup mechanism, a second line of defense that can do the job even if the first line should fail. It involves a unique chemical compound that poisons the malignant cell while nourishing all the rest. And this is where the vitamin concept of cancer finally comes back into the picture. The chemical compound in question, of course, is vitamin B17, which is found in those natural foods containing nitrilicides. It's known also as amygdalin, and as such has been used and studied extensively for well over 100 years. But in its concentrated and purified form, developed by Dr. Krebs specifically for cancer therapy, it is known as Laetril. For the sake of clarity in this presentation, however, we shall favor the more simple name, vitamin B17. The B17 molecule contains 2 units of sugar, 1 of benzaldehyde, and 1 of cyanide, all tightly locked together within it. Now, as everyone knows, cyanide can be highly toxic and even fatal if taken in sufficient quantity. However, locked as it is in this natural state, it's completely inert chemically and has absolutely no effect on living tissue. There is only one substance that can unlock this molecule and release the cyanide. That substance is an enzyme called beta-glucosidase, which we shall call the unlocking enzyme. When B17 comes in contact with this enzyme, not only is the cyanide released, but also the benzaldehyde, which is highly toxic by itself. In fact, these two working together are at least 100 times more poisonous than either of them separately. The unlocking enzyme is not found to any dangerous degree anywhere in the body, except at the cancer cell, where it always is present in great quantity. The result is that vitamin B17 is unlocked at the cancer cell. It becomes poisonous to the cancer cell, and only to the cancer cell. There's another important enzyme called rhodanase, which we shall identify as the protecting enzyme. The reason is that it has the ability to neutralize cyanide by converting it instantly into byproducts that actually are beneficial and essential for health. This enzyme is found in great quantities in every part of the body except the cancer cell, which consequently is not protected. Here then is a biochemical process that destroys cancer cells while at the same time nourishes and sustains non-cancer cells. It's an intricate and perfect mechanism of nature that simply couldn't have been accidental. There's much speculation today about carcinogens, the things that supposedly cause cancer. We're told that researchers now have proven that smoking or excessive exposure to the sun or chemical additives to our food or even certain viruses all can cause cancer. But as we have seen, the real cause is an enzyme and vitamin deficiency. These other things merely are the specific triggers that start the process. Anything that produces prolonged stress or damage to the body can trigger off the production of estrogen as a part of the healing process. If this goes unchecked because the body lacks the necessary chemical ingredients to fight back, then the result is cancer. Specific carcinogens, therefore, do not cause cancer. They merely determine where it's going to occur. Of course, nature's defenses against cancer include more than just the pancreatic enzymes and vitamin B17. Research has shown that an important role also may be played by other enzymes, other vitamins, oxygenation of the blood, pH levels, and even body temperature. Vitamin B17 seems to be the most vital and direct acting of all these factors, but none of them can be ignored, for they're an interlocking part of the total natural mechanism. Fortunately, it's not necessary for man to understand fully every theoretical aspect of this mechanism in order to make it work for him in practice. All that he really needs to know is the necessity of eating foods rich in all the vitamins and minerals, and of minimizing damage or stress to the body. The reality of the vitamin B17 concept of cancer has been proven in the laboratory beyond any doubt. For example, Dr. Dean Burke, head of the cytochemistry section of the National Cancer Institute, has reported that in a series of tests on animal tissue, the B17 had no effect on normal cells, but released so much cyanide and benzaldehyde when it came in contact with cancer cells that not one of them could survive. He said, "When we add Laetril to a cancer culture under the microscope, we can see the cancer cells dying off like flies." We've said that vitamin B17 is harmless to non-cancer cells. This is true, but perhaps it would be more accurate to say that it's as harmless as any substance can be. After all, even life-essential water or oxygen can be fatal if taken in unnaturally large doses. And this is true also of vitamin B17. For example, there's one case of a man who reportedly died from devouring almost a cup of apple seeds. Incidentally, the case never has been authenticated, but assuming it's true, if the man had eaten the apples also, he would have obtained enough extra rhodanase from the whole fruit to offset the effect of even that many seeds in his stomach. But that would have required that he eat several cases of apples, which of course would have been impossible in the first place. Nature can do only so much. It cannot anticipate excess of this kind. Therefore, it's wise to follow the simple rule that one should not eat at one time more seeds than he likely would consume if he also were eating a reasonable quantity of the whole fruit. This is a common sense rule with a large safety margin that can be followed with complete confidence. Now, when it comes to the laboratory forms of vitamin B17, known as amygdalin or Laetril, there's even less cause for concern. For over 100 years, standard pharmacology reference books have described this substance as non-toxic. After a century of use in all parts of the world, there never has been a single reported case of related death or even serious illness. In one series of tests, White rats were fed 70 times the normal human dose of Laetril, and the only side effects produced were greater appetite, weight gain, and superior health, just what one would expect from taking a vitamin. Aspirin tablets are 20 times more toxic than the equivalent amount of Laetril. And in fact, Dr. Burke of the National Cancer Institute has demonstrated that Laetril is even less toxic than sugar. Let's turn now to the all-important question. Does Laetril, or vitamin B17, actually control cancer in human beings? And if it does, is there statistical evidence to support that claim? Spokesmen for organized medicine say no. Almost all official opposition to Laetril is based upon a 1953 report by the Cancer Commission of the California Medical Association. The report said flatly, "No satisfactory evidence has been produced to indicate any significant cytotoxic effect of Laetril on the cancer cell." Using this report as a primary reference, government agencies soon declared that it was illegal to prescribe, transport, or even recommend Laetril. The report was written by the committee chairman, Dr. Ian McDonald, and the committee secretary, Dr. Henry Garland. There were seven other prominent physicians appointed to the committee, but none of them, not even the men who wrote the report, had any personal experience with Laetril. They had based their conclusions entirely on the written records of other experimenters. The scientific judgment of these men perhaps can be best appreciated by noting that McDonald and Garland were the doctors who had made headlines claiming that there was no connection between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. In fact, McDonald had claimed that 24 cigarettes per day was a harmless pastime, and then he said, "A pack a day keeps lung cancer away." But even more important than this scientific ineptitude is the fact that both men actually had falsified their summary of the Laetril experiments. For example, their report claimed that microscopic examinations of tumors taken from patients treated with Laetril showed no evidence of beneficial chemical effect. Yet, 10 years later, it was learned that one of the pathologists conducting the examinations, in fact, did report several instances of tumor destruction, which he stated at the time could well have been caused by the action of Laetril. McDonald and Garland had not told the truth. The report also stated that laboratory technicians had tried unsuccessfully to release cyanide from Laetril. This was offered as powerful evidence that the entire theory was a fraud. And yet, just 2 months prior to that, the American Medical Association Chemical Lab had reported that it had been successful in releasing cyanide from Laetril. And of course, other labs have done this also, including the California Food and Drug Lab, and of course, the cytochemistry lab of the National Cancer Institute. Again, McDonald and Garland had obscured the truth. Another important aspect of this report is that the patients had received extremely small doses of Laetril, much too small to prove anything. Today, it's not uncommon to administer 2 or 3 grams of the material in a single injection. Generally, 30 or 40 grams are required before the patient can report tangible signs of improvement. But in the California experiment, the maximum total dosage was only about 2 grams, and even that was divided among 12 injections. 5 patients had received only 2 injections, and 5 had received only 1. So it's not surprising that these experiments had failed to obtain convincing evidence that Laetril worked. What is surprising, however, is that this and similar discredited reports continue to be cited by the American Cancer Society as proof that Laetril is a hoax. But let's return to the original side of this question. What evidence is there to support the claim that Laetril does work? As we have seen, the health records of the Hunzikuts, the Eskimos, and many other groups around the world are statistically conclusive that vitamin B17 does control cancer in human beings with an effectiveness approaching 100%. There can be little controversy over that. But what about cancer once it already has started? Can B17 restore a person to health after he has contracted the disease? The answer is yes, if it's caught in time, and if the patient isn't too badly damaged by prior X-ray treatment or toxic drugs. Unfortunately, most cancer victims start taking Laetril only after their disease is so far advanced that they've been given up as hopeless by routine medical channels. Usually they've been told that they have only a few more months or weeks to live. And it's in this tragic state of near death that they turn to vitamin therapy as a last resort. If they die, and indeed many of them do, then they are counted as statistical failures for Laetril. In reality, it's a victory for Laetril that any of them should be saved at this stage. For once a deficiency disease has progressed so far, the damage it does simply can't be reversed. A man who has been shot with a gun can have the bullet removed, but still die from the wound. Likewise, a patient can have his cancer destroyed by vitamin B17 and still die from the irreversible damage already done to his vital organs. And so, in view of this tremendous handicap, the number of terminal patients who have been restored to health is most impressive. In fact, there literally are thousands of such case histories in the medical record. The American Cancer Society has tried to create the impression that the only ones who claim to have been saved by Laetril are those who merely were hypochondriacs and who never really had cancer in the first place. But the record reveals quite a different story. Let's take a look at just a few examples. Mr. David Edmonds of Pinole, California, was operated on in June of 1971 for cancer of the colon, which also had metastasized or spread to the bladder. When the surgeon opened him up, he found that the malignant tissue was so widespread it was almost impossible to remove it all. The blockage of the intestines was relieved by severing the colon and bringing the open end to the outside of his abdomen, a procedure known as a colostomy. 5 months later, the cancer had returned, and Mr. Edmonds was told that he had only a few more months to live. Mrs. Edmonds, who was a nurse, had heard about Laetril and decided to give it a try. 6 months later, instead of lying on his deathbed, Mr. Edmonds surprised the doctors by feeling well enough to resume an almost normal routine. An exploratory cystoscopy of the bladder revealed that the cancer there had completely disappeared. At his own insistence, he was readmitted to the hospital to see if his colon could be put back together again. In surgery, they found nothing even resembling cancer tissue. So they reconnected the colon and sent him home to recuperate. It was the first time in the history of the hospital that a reverse colostomy had been performed. Mr. Edmonds now is living a near-normal life of health and vigor. In 1967, Mrs. Joan Wilkinson had a tumor removed from her lower left leg, just below the thigh. 4 months later, there was a recurrence requiring additional surgery and the removal of muscle and bone. A year later, a lump in the groin appeared, and a biopsy revealed that her cancer had returned and was spreading. Her doctor told her that surgery would be necessary again, but this time they would have to amputate the leg, the hip, and probably the bladder and one of the kidneys as well. The plan was to open up her lungs first to see if cancer had located there. If it had, then they would not amputate, because there wouldn't be any chance of saving her anyway. At the urging of her sister and a mutual friend, Mrs. Wilkinson decided not to undergo surgery, but to try Laetril instead. Her doctor was upset by this, and he told her that if she didn't have the surgery, she couldn't possibly live longer than 12 weeks. 5 weeks after starting on Laetril, the lump in her groin had disappeared. Today, years later, she's living a healthy and productive life. In 1972, Dr. Dale Danner, a podiatrist from Santa Paula, California, developed a pain in the right leg and a severe cough. X-rays revealed a carcinoma of both lungs and what appeared to be massive secondary tumors in the leg. The cancer was inoperable and resistant to radiotherapy. The prognosis was incurable and fatal. At the insistence of his mother, Dr. Danner agreed to try Laetril, although he had no faith in its effectiveness. Primarily just to please her, he obtained a large supply in Mexico. But he was convinced from what he had read in the medical journals that it was nothing but quackery and a fraud. Perhaps it was even dangerous, he thought, for he noticed from the literature that it contained large amounts of cyanide. Within a few weeks, the pain and the coughing had progressed to the point where no amount of medication could hold it back. Forced to crawl on his hands and knees, and unable to sleep for 3 days and nights, he became despondent and desperate. Groggy from the lack of sleep, from the drugs, and from the pain. Finally, he turned to his supply of Laetril. Giving himself one more massive dose of medication, hopefully to bring on sleep, He then proceeded to administer the Laetril directly into an artery. Before losing consciousness from the medication, Dr. Danner had succeeded in taking at least an entire 10-day supply, and possibly as high as a 20-day supply, all at once. When he awoke 36 hours later, much to his amazement, not only was he alive, but also the cough and pain were greatly reduced. His appetite had returned, and he was feeling better than he had in months. Reluctantly, he had to admit that Laetril was working. So he obtained an additional supply and began routine treatment with smaller doses. 3 months later, he was back to work. Since Laetril was developed in 1952, there have been literally thousands of similar case histories reported and documented. And when all these are viewed as a group, they begin to take on the form of numerical statistics, which of course are more meaningful than individual cases. There have been at least 26 published medical papers written by well-known physicians who have used Laetril experimentally in the treatment of their own patients, and who have concluded that Laetril is both safe and effective in the treatment of cancer. The American Cancer Society and other spokesmen for the medical establishment would have us believe that only crackpots have endorsed this conclusion. But the doctors who conducted these experiments and those who share their conclusions are not quacks. Here are just a few of the names. In West Germany, there is Dr. Hans Nieper, director of the Department of Medicine at the Silbersee Hospital in Hanover. He is a pioneer in the medical use of cobalt and is credited with developing the anti-cancer drug cyclophosphamide. Undoubtedly, he is one of the world's most famous and respected cancer specialists. In Canada, there is Dr. N.R. Bouzian, director of research laboratories at St. Jean d'Arc Hospital in Montreal. He is a member of the hospital's tumor board in charge of chemotherapy. Also, he is dean of the American Association of Bioanalysts. In the Philippines, there is Dr. Manuel Navarro, professor of medicine and surgery at the University of Santo Tomas in Manila. He is distinguished internationally as a cancer researcher and has over 100 major scientific papers to his credit, some of which have been read before the International Cancer Congress. In Mexico, there is Dr. Ernesto Contreras, who for over a decade has operated the famous Good Samaritan Cancer Clinic in Tijuana. He is one of Mexico's most distinguished medical figures. He received postgraduate training at Harvard's Children's Hospital in Boston. He has served as professor of histology and pathology at the Mexican Army Medical School and as the chief pathologist at the Army Hospital in Mexico City. In Belgium, there is Dr. Mazen of the University of Louvain. In Italy, there is Dr. Giudetti of the University of Turin. In Japan, there is Dr. Sakai, a prominent physician in Tokyo. And in the United States, there are such respected names as Dr. Burke of the National Cancer Institute, Dr. Marone of the Jersey City Medical Center, Dr. Krebs, who developed Laetril, Dr. Richardson of San Francisco, and many more from over 20 countries with equally impeccable credentials. These researchers have reported that most of their patients experience several important side effects, including an immediate lowering of blood pressure, improved appetite, an increase in the hemoglobin and red blood cell count, and above all, a release from pain without narcotics. Even if the patient has started Laetril therapy too late to be saved, this last effect is a merciful blessing in itself. In the United States, if a doctor wishes to avoid being labeled a quack, he must practice what is called consensus medicine. In other words, he must use only those treatments that generally are also used by his colleagues. At the present time, in the field of cancer, those are limited to surgery, X-ray, and drugs. For comparison, therefore, let's turn now to the results and benefits attained through these so-called orthodox treatments. As we shall see, surgery is the least harmful of the three, and in some cases, it can be a life-saving stopgap measure. Surgery also has the psychological advantage of visibly removing the tumor. And from that point of view, it offers the patient and his family some comfort and hope. However, the degree to which surgery is useful is the same degree to which the tumor is not malignant. The greater the proportion of cancer cells in that tumor, the less likely it is that surgery will help. And the most highly malignant tumors of all generally are considered inoperable. the statistical rate of long-term survival after surgery is, at best, only 10 or 15%. And once the cancer has metastasized to a secondary location, surgery has almost no survival value whatsoever. The reason, of course, is that, like the other therapies approved by organized medicine, surgery removes only the tumor. It does not remove the cause. The rationale behind X-ray therapy is essentially the same as with surgery. The medical objective is to remove the tumor, but to do so by burning it away rather than cutting it out. Here also, it's primarily the non-cancer cell that's destroyed. The more malignant the tumor, the more resistant it is to radiotherapy. In fact, this procedure has all the same limitations and drawbacks of surgery, plus one more. It actually increases the likelihood that cancer will develop in other parts of the body. Yes, it's a well-established fact that excessive exposure to radioactivity is an effective way to induce cancer. This had been demonstrated not only among the survivors of Hiroshima, but a research team at the University of Buffalo recently reported that less than a dozen routine medical X-rays to the same part of the body increases the risk of leukemia by at least 60%. And these routine X-rays are nothing compared to the intense radiation used on cancer patients. X-rays induce cancer because of at least two factors. First, they do physical damage to the body, which triggers off the production of trophoblast cells as part of the healing process. Second, they weaken or destroy the production of white blood cells, which, as we have seen, constitute the immunological defense mechanism, the body's frontline defense against cancer. As with all forms of currently popular treatments, once the cancer has metastasized to a second location, there is practically no chance that the radiology patient will live. So, in addition to an almost zero survival value, radiotherapy has the extra distinction of also spreading the very cancer it's supposed to combat. The record of so-called anti-cancer drugs is even worse. Most of them currently in use are highly poisonous, not just to cancer, but to the rest of the body as well. In fact, generally, they are more deadly to healthy tissue than they are to the malignant cell. Most of these drugs are described as radiomimetic, which means that they mimic or produce the same effects as radiation. Consequently, they also suppress the immunological defense mechanism, and thus help to spread the cancer to other areas. But whereas X-rays usually are directed to only one or two locations, these chemicals do their deadly work on every cell in the entire body. The use of exotic and highly toxic drugs is the latest fad in cancer therapy. As scores of these drugs are developed each year, cancer patients become the human guinea pigs upon which they're tested. The tragic results are well depicted in the following statements taken from just a few of the official chemotherapy reports of the National Cancer Institute. An effort was made to choose patients who were well enough to withstand the anticipated toxicity. Early death of two of the first five patients treated caused a reduction to 8 mg/kg per day. No significant anti-tumor benefit of any duration was observed. In this study, 6 of the 8 children died. No therapeutic effect was observed. Toxic clinical manifestations consisted of vomiting, hypertension, changes in oral mucous membranes, and diarrhea. Renal damage and cerebral edema were observed at post-mortem examination in each of the 6 patients who died while receiving this drug. The death of 2 patients was unequivocally caused by drug toxicity. 8 of the 14 patients who survived their initial courses of therapy showed rapid and general deterioration and died within 10 weeks after therapy began. And so it goes, year in and year out, deadly experiments, fully approved by organized medicine. Experiments that can be viewed only as a form of human vivisection. This, then, is the comparison between vitamin therapy and orthodox treatments. The statistics that follow are taken from the National Cancer Institute, the American Cancer Society, and from the clinical records of those physicians who have used Laetril in the treatment of their own patients. They vary widely depending on the age of the patient, the sex, the cancer location, and the degree of malignancy. Consequently, the figures shown will be averages for all kinds and all groups together, This is the story they tell. Of those with advanced metastasized cancer who have been told by their physician that there is no hope, only 15% will be saved when they turn to vitamin therapy, which is not good. But under orthodox treatment, less than 1 out of 1,000, or 1/10 of 1%, will survive 5 years. Of those with early diagnosed cancer, at least 80% will be saved by vitamin therapy. But no more than 15% will survive under orthodox treatment. And of those who presently are healthy with no clinical cancer to begin with, close to 100% can expect to be free from cancer as long as they routinely obtain adequate amounts of vitamin B17. But those who subsist on the typical American diet and rely only on the therapies of organized medicine are doomed to a survival rate of just 84%. And that figure includes all ages. It is much less for those above 30. As mentioned previously, these figures will vary widely depending on age, sex, cancer location, and degree of malignancy. Also, they're somewhat arbitrary when it comes to separating early diagnosed cancers from those that are advanced, for often there's a gray area between the two. Nevertheless, in general, they are as accurate as any such tabulation can be, and they tell an impressive story that cannot be brushed aside. Considering the lack of results obtained by orthodox medicine, it's been said that voodoo witchcraft would be just as effective, and perhaps even more so, for at least then the patient would be spared the deadly side effects of radiation and chemical poisoning. Just as we are amused today at the primitive medical practices of history, future generations surely will look back at our own era and cringe at the senseless cutting, burning, and poisoning that now passes for medical science. No matter how useless or even harmful current practices may be, consensus medicine demands that they be used by every physician. Regardless of how many patients are lost, the doctor's professional standing is upheld because those who pass judgment through peer review are using the same treatments and getting the same tragic results. On the other hand, if a doctor deviates from this pattern and dares to apply nutrition as the basis of his treatment, even if he attains a high degree of success, he is condemned as a quack. He may lose his hospital privileges and even is subject to arrest. There's no doubt that most of the opposition to vitamin therapy comes from well-intentioned people who simply don't yet have all the facts. But vested interest also plays an important role. As stated at the beginning of this presentation, the science of cancer therapy isn't nearly as complicated as the politics of cancer therapy. The history of how these vested interests have succeeded in influencing the medical profession, government agencies, and public opinion is a fascinating story by itself. But of course, time doesn't permit it to be told here. For the full story of both the science and the politics, read World Without Cancer. This book contains all the information presented in this film, plus a great deal more. It includes extensive extracts from primary research documents and is amply footnoted so that the serious student can pursue his own avenues of investigation. The information contained could well save their lives. Once vitamin B17 is as widely understood and available as other vitamins, cancer then will be as rare as is scurvy or pellagra today. When nitrilicides are used perhaps as a routine seasoning to our food, like iodized table salt, then the battle finally will be won. This is our goal, and it's an objective that can be reached right now by anyone who will act upon this knowledge. You and your family now may become secure from cancer, but that's only because someone else has helped to bring these facts to your attention. Can you do less for others? Join with us in this noble task. Together, we can create a world without cancer.
So there you have it, my friends. My full research there dealing with the issue of many of the things that we're told today are incurable. I hand my research work over to you to let you do further research on blood purifiers, blood electrification, vitamin B17 and Laetril and amygdalin and a lot of these other things. Maybe this message might not only be able to change people's lives, but it may be able to save people's lives. I don't know what kind of hammer may drop on us here for getting this information out to you, so I hope that you will save it to your computer and spread the message on others. And that's about the best we can do here. That's our job at the Underground Christian Network. We venture into the dark and we shine a light, and we bring the information back to you to let you know what's there. Until next we meet.
You're tuned in with the Underground Christian Network.